Welcome to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And this week, we're going to talk about wine, Cindy, if that's okay.
That sounds good to me.
We haven't spent any time on it recently, and and I miss it. I miss wine. And so, okay, here's the thing that's gone crazy. Rosé has gone crazy.
Which we would not have said 20 years ago. I mean, it is really interesting.
There's even frozen rosé concoctions being served at a number of places.
All right, fun.
Frosé. But, well, people want something refreshing. Rosé is inherently refreshing. It's usually served pretty darn cold. And it's changed a lot the way it's been perceived.
Why do you think that is?
I think, I think that people want something new, for certain. And I think that people want something that's just a happy beverage. You know, certainly something that's pink communicates that. And I think that for a glass of wine in a restaurant or in a good bar, it's a very easy thing to ask for. If you're trying to have a meal outside, it's a very easy thing to throw in a nice bucket.
It certainly speaks to the summertime.
And there are very few very inexpensive ones. You know, rosé champagne, that's a different story. And a lot of those wines are great and very precise, but there's an awful lot of rosé. The original thing that was popular was rosé from Provence. That was the thing, the image of being along the Côte d'Azur and, you know, various movie stars.
Yeah.
You know, and with giant sunglasses from the 1950s.
Definitely. Yes.
Sitting out there and all the bon vivant. Having a glass of refreshing rosé in the Mediterranean sun. That's what was sold a long time ago. I was talking to an importer recently of French wine, and he said the rosé production has gone from 2 million bottles a year to 11 million bottles
a year
in 3 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
In Provence. So that's just Côte de Provence. And along the Mediterranean.
I wonder if Brad Pitt getting involved with the winemaker from Chateauneuf, that got a lot of press too. So that was several years ago.
When it hits People magazine,
everybody knows it. It was on the cover of Spectator. It was a big article, but you're right. I mean, it was even in People magazine. So that's kind of interesting. I'm sure that didn't hurt.
I think that definitely made a difference. It's funny how there's often one media event. There's one film that blew up, Pinot Noir, you know?
What film was
and
it?
And that hurt Merlot, Sideways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that,
that's right.
And hilarious, but but a little bit damning for Merlot. Mm. There was a time, late 80s, early 90s, when everyone wanted a glass of Merlot.
Okay.
It wasn't as tannic as the cabs, and honestly, sort of flavorless cabs coming from the West Coast in a lot of the 80s. And It was not as fruity or alcoholic as Zinfandel. It was that compromise wine that an awful lot of people, I'll have a glass of Merlot. And that's become, recently, I'll have a glass of Pinot Noir. But people diversified a lot, and they become much more sophisticated in general about wine. Just the fact that more places will serve you something in an appropriate temperature is great.
Yeah, in the appropriate glass.
But in a retail wine shop, we've gone from 2002 having 4 rosé at the height of the season to right now there are 19.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
On the shelf.
That's
and it used to be we'd have them for a couple of months. And then if you had stock after August 1st, you were dead. You're going to look at that stock for the rest of the year, you know, maybe drink it. That's about it. But you're not going to sell it. Now we have to have a section all year long. It's just a giant change.
Yeah, interesting.
As a percentage of business, it's only about 6 times what it was 15 years ago in a retail store. So that's a giant shift. And I don't want to say rosé is the new Merlot.
No.
Because that's a ridiculous thing.
No, but it's interesting that it is has become so popular.
Yeah.
And the why of it.
Well, and the why, I mean, for me, the why is that's like your secret weapon against tomatoes.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well,
there are very few wines that match
pairing.
Tomatoes.
Right.
There are not a lot of whites that actually carry it with flavors. And you don't want an oaky white. That vanilla and tomato thing is not my favorite idea of a combination. And some of the, you don't want something snappy and shrill, lemon and tomato. No, thank you very much. But something that is juicy, something that balances the acidity, that has a little more charm, that makes that turns that red tomato to pink.
Well, and also you talked about how people become more educated and knowledgeable. I mean, I think the whole idea that for how many years now people can go in and have a 3-ounce pour of something and they don't feel like it's such a gigantic commitment. Oh, a 3-ounce pour, whatever, you know, a small tasting. So, oh, I can see if I like this or not. Or well, the opportunity to get to taste, you know, even maybe have a, you know, a little taste of something before you commit to it is pretty cool.
People's excitement of pairings is part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the wine function really well. That's, you know, if it's actually being used the way it's supposed to be used or intended or is most successful, then you get more excited about it. I think that's happened for a lot of things. You know, I've watched Grüneveltliner, which is, you know, an off-the-radar white wine,
mm-hmm.
become much more accepted over the years, which makes me happy because I love Grüneveltliner.
Okay.
But rosé is definitely a phenomenon. It's not just a change. It's a phenomenon.
All right.
And so coming up on the program, we have 3 different producers that we're going to sort of do a little round the world and, well, 3 rosés this afternoon. And one is Airfield Estate in Washington State, Eastern Washington State, that produces a really nice rosé with body, with a little more muscle. If you wanted rosé for a burger, this is definitely what you're after.
All right.
And then we'll talk to Domaine Fenouillet that makes a pretty classic Côte du Rhône rosé.
Beautiful, beautiful place.
So Northern Provence,
mm-hmm.
Largely Grenache, and a wine of charm and lightness and freshness. And that wine you expect from the Côte d'Azur. And then the third is Vaida. You don't think of rosé from Italy very much.
No.
That's something that's changed. It used to be you'd find a few in Abruzzo, Cerasuolo d'Abruzzo, that kind of thing. But now there are a few popping up, and they've been making for a few years a rosato called Rosabella. And this is, for me, maybe this year, one of my very favorites because of its flexibility. Italian wine always has to have good acidity because it's what works with the food.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, honestly, with a lot of charcuterie, salumi, this is going to be very successful. If you're having a cold supper, this is going to be very successful. And the wines are all reasonably priced.
That's great.
That's the thing, is you can have the most remarkable rosés and not hurt yourself.
Very good.
Or hurt your budget, I should say.
Mm-hmm. No, it's exciting to get to talk with all these wonderful winemakers.
So we should move on and do that, shouldn't we?
Do it. Let's do it.
So as I prefaced, we have Brad Potter coming on from Airfield in Washington State to begin the discussion of what's going on with the rosé in the world. Brad, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So when did you guys begin making a rosé?
We started doing rosé about 8 years ago. It's something we... Our estate itself has 27 different varietals planted, and one of those is Sangiovese, and we loved what the Sangiovese was doing on the rosé level. And so we started making it early on for us. It was one of our first varietals we started making.
Yeah, and that's definitely before the sort of explosion that's happened in rosé. How has the demand changed over time for you guys for the wine?
It really has just exploded over the past 3 or 4 years. We've gone from making just a couple hundred cases early on to we make just about 2,000 cases now. And we are essentially sold out already. And here it is.
Good for you. That's great.
Yeah, no, I know we have great success and great response on your wine. It's just been an interesting thing to see for some like me, I'm 51, to watch it go from such an uncool wine to all of a sudden, it's what everybody wants.
Oh, absolutely! You know, I'm 50 as well. So, you know, I've been in the industry for a little over 20 years, and to see it go from what used to be, if it was pink, everyone assumed it was white Zinfandel, and especially on the West Coast, to what, you know, good dry rosé has become now, is just it's been a phenomenal, you know, growth curve.
So what do you tell people with the Sangiovese rosé that you guys make? What should they be doing with it? How should they serve it? What temperature? All that kind of business.
I tell especially red wine drinkers. You know, we have a lot of people who are specifically, they say, oh, I only drink red wine. I tell them then rosé is perfect for you because it's that summertime wine that's made from red grapes. And so we sell a lot of it that way. But I just tell people that the rosé is the perfect wine. It really it can go with most anything. It's fruity. It's bright. But it's refreshing as well. So that, you know, we've really tried to promote the versatility of rosé.
How about a couple of technical details? How do you guys make your rosé?
We do it. You know, the general consensus I tell people is we take the red wine grapes and we make it like a white. So we press the grapes early on. And get just a little bit of the hue out of it then. And then occasionally we'll add back a little bit of color, a little bit of Sangiovese to get a little more color into it. But typically it's treated like a white wine.
So it's not a Saunier for your Sangiovese?
No. It's typically made as a rosé from the start.
And a lot of people, it ends up being a byproduct of their reds, and they taste it and they say, oh, well, this is lovely.
Yeah. No, it's a conscious decision that we make even as early on in the vineyards that this is going to be, you know, a lot of the rosé. We have a little bit of the pressing, and occasionally there's some of that added back in that style. But typically it's made from the start. We know that it's going to be the rosé.
Do you handle it differently in the vineyard because it's from inception intended to be rosé?
Yeah, I think a little bit. But
I mean harvest dates and things like that.
Yeah, slightly different. We're in Eastern Washington. We are blessed with typically the ability to harvest when we feel that the grapes are ready. You know, I worked in Oregon for a lot of years, and you're a little more at the mercy of the weather. But Eastern Washington, typically, it's a little bit more consistent in the fall, and so we're able to harvest when we feel that the grapes are ready rather than when Mother Nature says harvest or else. So we typically can bring the rosé or the Sangio off the vines exactly when we feel that it's appropriate for the rosé.
Do you guys leave any residual sugar in the wine?
There's just a touch, but typically no. I mean, it's less than 0.5% on the rosé.
For some wineries, it's sort of their dirty little secret.
Yeah, and we've tried that at times. You know, that's one of the things about where we're at. You know, we've only been making wines for about 12 years now. We've done a lot of different experimentation still, and we've tried some different things, but we really try to keep, you know, the residual sugar off there. Sometimes a touch of residual sugar just adds a little bit more flavor to it. But yeah, we really try not to have anything that's real sweet in the wines.
Would you take a moment and just remind listeners about the winery, where it is in Washington State, and the website so they can find more information out?
Sure. Yeah. So Airfield Estates, I mean, we started as grape growers, really. We planted our first grapes in 1968, and we started we were growing for some of the big producers in the state of Washington, Chateau St. Michel and some of the others. We started making our own wines when the great-grandson and granddaughter of the original owners, when they came of age. So we started making wines just in 2005, and we still use only about 25% of the grapes that we grow. So we keep, I always say, we keep the best for ourselves and sell the rest to everyone else. But yeah, we've been making wines for just 12 years, and we are located in Eastern Washington, kind of the heart of wine country in Yakima Valley, which is the coolest of the wine regions in the state. And our vineyard is in Sunnyside, which, if, for those who are familiar with Eastern Washington, is a very small farming community. And we've gone from, in those 12 years, from making about 3,000 cases of wine to making now just over 42,000. So we're growing very quickly, but it's all estate-grown grapes, everything that we do. So, and you can find information about us on our website at airfieldwines.com.
Brad, I'm curious, why do you think that rosé has blown up so much? Is it, you know, something to do with the way it's produced or and made, or what do you think is happening there?
You know, I think that what we're seeing in the wine, you know, industry is kind of a resurgence in some of these other wines. You know, there was obviously we're all familiar with the ABC phenomenon that happened, anything but Chardonnay, anything but Cabernet, and I think people wanted to try other things, and especially in the red wine industry. Now we're seeing kind of a resurgence in some of the white varietals. We're seeing more domestic Viogniers with that kind of resurgence, and you're seeing the same thing with Marsan and Roussan. And I think rosé is a byproduct of some of that. I think that it's different, and people have discovered it and really discovered how wonderful it can be. I don't know that there's more to it than that. I think that wine drinkers and wine lovers have a tendency to want to try new things.
Sure. That's good.
Well, Brad, thanks for coming on with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Look forward to seeing you at Airfield again.
You bet. Thanks so much.
Well, that was great. When we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we'll be covering a few more producers in different places with different philosophies.
That's exciting.
And then in the third segment, you know what you're going to have to face.
No, oh, something easy, probably.
Yeah, a really easy chef challenge.
Okay.
Like dunking on a 6-foot basket. All of that and more on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine on WYPR. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And the subject matter today is rosé, which everyone should love because everyone seems to love rosé right now.
It's an interesting trend.
And coming up in this segment, we have a couple of interviews with a French and Italian producer that they're going to have different perspectives on rosé than Brad Potter did from Airfield.
It will be interesting.
And our next subject on our rosé roundup is Justine Soir. Am I saying your name correctly?
Justine Soir.
Soir.
Hi, Justine. Thank you for being with us.
Hi. Thank you.
And so we're talking to a couple of different producers from Washington State, from Piemonte, and you all from probably the most famous place for rosé, the Provence, about what is happening with rosé, because in the United States it seems like it's gone crazy, the popularity of rosé. Has it been the same way in France?
Yes, it's very famous, yeah.
But I always recall people drinking rosé in France, especially rosé from Provence.
Yeah, so we are situated in the Vallée du Rhône.
So take a moment and tell us about the winery, some of the history.
We are located in the village called Baume de Venise. So we produce the appellation Muscat Baume de Venise. It's a sweet wine. We produce also red wines from Baume de Venise, and we have also the Ventoux, appellation Ventoux, so for the rosé, the white, and the red.
I often think of Baume de Venise, the red, as being one of the best values in Côte du Rhône village. A lot of the best vineyards are the same quality as Gigondas, and the pricing is never near that level. And so when did the winery begin?
We created the estates in 1989 with Patrick and Vincent, two brothers. So we have now about 30 hectares of vines.
Excellent. So how do you make your rosé?
We have the direct pressing and bleeding. We have the both production.
So part of the wine is rosé de Saigné.
Yes, rosé de Saigné et rosé de Presse.
What is the production of rosé now?
About 80 hectolitres.
And that's the production of rosé or production of all the wines for the
Vendée de Fomouillet? Only the rosé.
On the rosé. Has that changed over time?
Yes, it depends the year. It depends the production.
A lot of wineries in the United States and around the world have amped up their production of rosé because the demand has increased so much, but that has not affected you all.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the soil that your grapes grow in and what the environment is like? Because I will never forget visiting you all. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. The views from your vineyard sites are amazing. And I wish people could understand that. Can you speak about the soil and the land a little bit and the environment?
Only for the rosé or for all the vineyards?
For all your vineyards.
Okay, so we have some vineyard in the famous Dentel de Montmirail. I don't know if you know the place.
Yes.
But it's a wonderful place. And some vines are planted in terraces. In the altitude is about 400 meters, and the soil is clay limestone.
They're essentially crumbling ancient mountains that have vineyards terraced down the side.
Yeah, so this is one part of the vineyard, but after we have some other vines near the village of Baume de Venise, near the winery for the Muscat. And so the terroir is more, it's like sand.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So like sand for the Muscat.
Maybe speak for a moment about the characteristics of the wine, the rosé that you produce.
So the rosé is very fresh, very fruity, and easy to drink.
Is it intended to consume with the meal or solely as an aperitif?
Both. You can drink, because it's very fruity, you can drink it for the aperitif or with the meal. With a barbecue, it's a friendly wine.
How long is the wine intended to last in the cellar? Is it just consume this year's production and then next year consume the next year, or do you intend to have the wine in the cellar for a year or two?
For the rosé, you can drink it for a year or maximum 2 years. You have to drink the wine before 2 years.
So best in the first year?
Yes.
Maybe let people know who are listening the website, the contact for Domaine de Fenouillet.
Yes, so you can find all the wines on our website. So it's www.domaine-fenouillet.fr.
Excellent. Thanks, Justine. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you very much.
Au revoir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So nice to speak with Justine on our Rosé Roundup. Next up, we move to Italy. We move to Piemonte, and we go to Barolo, and we go to talk to Francesca Vaira. Francesca, how are you?
Very well, Tony. Thank you so much.
Would you take a moment and let people describe your winery and how people can find more information about Vaira? And then let's get into what's happened with Rosé in Italy.
Fantastic. I hope to be enough good to do so. It's a great honor to speak on behalf of my family and slightly also for Piemonte as well. Vaira is a family business, pretty long story and short story same time. Our great-grandparents were farmers in the upper part of the village of Barolo. Our grandparents were the very first family to move away from the town of Torino and go back and move to leaving the countryside and move to the town of Torino. And so our father, being a city guy and being 15 years old, he went back to his roots and moved back to the little village of Barolo. He had the dream to be a farmer, as his grandparents were. And since the beginning, his love for this work made him trying to take out the best from everything. So really taking care of the fruit and taking care also of the environment where he was farming, having the feeling that since you are a farmer, you completely belong to the countryside. And so you really need to take care about what is giving you the food and what makes your life so happy. So he started until 1985. He was partially before a student, then a teacher, and partially a farmer. Back in 1985, decided to completely dedicate his life to this job. At the beginning, immediately the year after, a very big hailstorm completely destroyed all their production, all their vineyards. So he and our mom, they start to wonder how to do. And actually, they start to think about sizing down the property, turning everything into a job of two. And what happened instead was that the older farmer of the area, they came here asking our parents their what they were thinking about, and hearing that they wanted to stay here, they were not scared about that airstorm. They asked them to take care of their exploitation. So this really made what is the Vaira right now. Back in 1986, so instead of sizing down the property, another opportunity arose. And this other opportunity was about giving voice to different plots within the Barolo production area. And that also made possible to give voice to all the different varieties of Piemonte. And
so, Francesca, let's boil it down to Rosé, Rosato.
Absolutely. It started back in 2004. We made the Rosabella in between 04 and 07. And in 2008, the fruit started to deliver us like incredible concentration of aromatics. And we thought it was like those vines were ready really to move into the next stage to help us in the production of the single varieties, like the Dolcetto d'Alba, the Barbera d'Alba, and the Langhe Nebbiolo we do make. And was they were probably giving too much concentration for what we are looking for into the Rosabella.
Rosabella is the name of your rosé, your rosato.
Exactly. It became for a funny story. We were thinking about making this rosato, and the same year we had a guy coming from Australia. He was supposed to spend a few weeks with us for the harvest and kind of like fall in love with Vaira and spend way longer time, over almost like 3 months. Mm. And one of the kids, he was with he and of course his family. Her name was Bella, and it came like almost like a tribute to this beautiful girl being 2 years old and spending time in Piemonte.
That's wonderful.
With our family. Rosa is rose. Bella is the Italian word for beautiful. So the name of this wine is Beautiful Rose. And this is also what you can find on the front of the label. Rosabella is a blend of three red grapes coming from the Barolo production area. Is Nebbiolo, Barbera, and Dolcetto. Nebbiolo is the main grape inside this blend. It's over like a 70% of Nebbiolo, 20% Barbera, and 10% Dolcetto.
Where is the fruit coming from for the wine? Is it coming from a little bit from a Seigneur, or is it being grown specifically for the wine?
So at Vaira, we love the life, and we try to embrace life in all its different stages. We know that when the vines are very young, they are not able to give us the concentration, the structure we are looking for a Barolo, for example. And same time that we know that if we will try to get that kind of concentration through green harvest, we are kind of like going to screw the vine itself. So what we are trying to do is let the vine express themselves and express their youthness when they are younger. And then we know that in a natural way, the quantity is going to be decreased, but the quality is going to increase. So with the fruit coming from the younger vines, usually vines up to 10 years old, we use those fruit in order to make the Rosabella and the Langhe Rosso.
So how has the production changed as far as quantity from 2004 through now, 2017? The demand has changed enormously in a lot of the world. I wonder how it's affected you.
So maybe because we are so old world that we are still looking at the nature, but our production of rosé is definitely answering more than the request for the market, really what the vines can give us. We know we cannot pretend to get.
So the demand is not affecting what decision making for you all And the demand is not, you don't sell out immediately on the wine.
Exactly. We know that virus for bank system is a pure nightmare. But no decision was ever taken via just following the market, just following the money, and that is more about really embracing the nature, trying to get the best out of that. In this, I mean, looking at the fact we still make Dolcetto, and we also make Dolcetto in Cruo Barolo, as we do make Barbera in a Cruo Barolo, I think it's kind of like an easy way to explain how we do work here.
Francesca, can I ask you what some of your favorite dishes are with the rosé, please?
I'm sure, Cindy, you have a
experience.
No,
no, I want to know your local cooking, what you all like to have there in your town with the rosé.
I found the Rosabella to be extremely versatile. That's because we do have a citrus note, but then roses and pomegranate, and there is complexity and simplicity going on into these glasses that really make it super friendly. It's what I love to bring when I'm having like an outdoor dinner with my friends.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what you're going to have in some of those dinners is a little bit of everything. There's definitely vegetables. There's definitely a bit of cheese and mm-hmm. charcuterie.
Very good.
That is really what I love to pair with this wine.
Just for fun. So people will want to see more about Vaira. Would you give people an idea of the web address? And we will put up the web address on the Foreman & Wolf homepage on the WYPR site, wypr.org. So where can people find you all to learn more?
So you can find Vaira at www.gdvaira.it.
Well, Francesca, I look forward to seeing you again here. I look forward to seeing you again in Italy. And
yes.
As always, nice to have a conversation with you.
I would love to come. And thank you so much for talking with us. A fascinating story and a wonderful family history. And you must be very proud of what you do. Your work is amazing. And we thank you for it.
Grazie mille.
Grazie.
Bye-bye. Ciao.
Ciao.
Well, very cool to have Francesca on.
That was very special.
Well, when we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, we do a bit of a wrap-up and then, of course, an unbelievably easy chef's challenge for Chef Cindy Wolf. All of that and more on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, are you already drunk on rosé?
Oh, that was fun, though, to have all those interviews and different perspectives from different countries. That was amazing. Who would have thought that rosé would become so popular? It is interesting.
Well, anything Francesco's going to talk about is going to become popular.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For sure. She's amazing.
Yeah,
that was fun. She's a beautiful speaker.
Pretty passionate.
Yeah.
So I need to know a couple of things. One, what is your favorite rosé you've ever had?
I don't ever remember having a rosé. I really don't.
You've never had rosé champagne?
I mean, I'm sure. Oh, a rosé champagne.
See, that's the big one we're missing.
Okay.
That's the big one we're missing.
Oh, that I can answer. But
I knew that because I know you love rosé champagne.
Yeah, and you know I'm not a rosé drinker, so it's just not for any reason other than I don't know why, actually. I don't even own any rosé. Okay, so rosé champagne. Oh, boy. Rosé champagne. Bicard. Is what Gosse rosé. Oh my gosh, different years and even the non-vintage, of course. Not even the non-vintage, of course, as well. And there have been some Clicquot over the years rosés that I've loved. Those are the ones that come immediately to my mind. But yeah, you're right. We haven't talked about rosé champagne.
Well, and one of the things that people always ask about with rosé champagne is, do they do the fermentations? You know, do they are they just taking red grapes out and leaving it a little bit colored? And for the most part, they aren't. For the most part, they're actually fermenting the wine normally and adding red wine.
Okay.
Red still wine to the wine before secondary fermentation, which is kind of crazy.
So it's part of the dosage?
No, it's sort of like they make a it's almost like a cocktail.
Okay.
Dosage comes at the end,
mm-hmm.
so that the wine has more time together. But that's the one technical thing to know.
Mixing of the wine in the beginning before it becomes
Sometimes it's 90%
bottled, barreled, or
white and 10% red, and that's how you get that rosé.
Bottled. Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing to know.
What are some of the red grapes that they use besides Pinot Noir?
Well, Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier are the two red grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And Chardonnay is the white. And there are certainly sparkling from other parts of the world that have rosé, that are like Reventos. Reventos makes an excellent rosé. Conca. Conca is the appellation that took over for Cava.
Mm-hmm.
And there are rosé variations sparkling in a bunch of different places. Rotor Estate in California produces excellent rosé sparkling that's very much in champagne style.
Absolutely.
It's not the same piece of money. Although I think the best value in rosé champagne is a small producer Gonet Medville, GONET-MEDEVILLE.
Mm-hmm.
Their rosé is fabulous, and it's not the price of the famous labels.
Well, and what about, doesn't Fournier? Don't they make a rosé that's really, I mean, that's affordable and super fun.
Yeah, the wine's very good. Very particular style, too.
What's the obvious choice for rosé? Is it seafood?
I mean, to me, it's
or there is no one necessary.
To me, it's the secret of tomato. Like, what it grows together, it goes together.
Oh, right, of course.
It's the secret of summertime, vegetables that are stronger, vegetables that require wine with personality. But think about it. Zucchini and vanilla, like you might find in a Chardonnay, not attractive. Tomatoes and big, punchy, tannic wine, not that attractive. You want the tomatoes with a crispy red or rosé or very, very crispy white, but they often don't have quite the body. You want a little bit of tannin for especially dishes made with tomatoes. So that to me, tomatoes and rosé are one of the very good connections about summertime.
Okay, good.
Are you ready for the chef's challenge?
Yeah. Do I have a situation?
You sure you're ready?
Tony, do I have a situation?
I've not given you a situation because I said this was going to be unbelievably easy.
Oh, okay.
If you recall. Really? I said it was going to be like dunking on a 6-foot basket.
Oh, I did forget you said
this
that.
This is super easy.
I've forgotten that. Okay.
You have all the time in the world. You have all the time in the world.
Uh-huh.
This is on your new Montague range.
Range?
Why not?
What is that?
Aren't they still fancy ranges?
I don't know what that even is.
You know me, I've got like the off-brand range.
You mean La Cornue?
Well, La Cornue is very
range.
Fancy.
There you go. That's my
Once
range.
Upon a time, Montague was a big deal.
My La Cornue is competitive with all the other American brands.
I think
so
it just showed my age. There are chefs laughing all over the world.
All over the world?
All over
if
the world.
If only we had people listening from all over the world.
WYPR is available on the web, and this broadcast has a massive following, not just in the Baltimore area.
That's hilarious.
We have had emails from exotic locations like Colorado. Anyway,
all right.
Stop your stalling.
All right. Pork chops, garlic, nectarines. Ooh, I like it already. Arugula, cauliflower, cilantro, mint, jasmine rice. Oh, jasmine. Lima beans, fingerling potatoes, Roma tomatoes, all dairy, spice rack, kitchen garden.
The rice is not named for your niece, Jasmine.
I know. I love jasmine. You know, I usually roll right into this, but I kind of like this list.
Oh, this is, you have leisure.
Oh, yeah.
This is your leisure challenge.
I just don't want to leave dead space on the radio. Jasmine rice needs to be made with water, quite frankly, because jasmine rice has such a beautiful perfume all on its own. It doesn't need stock. So I'll just cook it off in water with salt. And I'm not even going to add any fat to it. So the jasmine rice needs to be cooked off first. And then I'll blanch the lima beans. I will roast the fingerling potatoes. So I'll roast the fingerling potatoes with corn oil, salt, and pepper, and I will put a little bit of – I'll perfume that corn oil with a little bit of rosemary stems.
You could roast them whole or split them?
No, I'll slice them. I like the things to happen quickly. So I'll slice like a fingerling potato. Typically, you can slice it twice. And if they're Russian fingerlings, that's about right. And you always want to have them be the same size, same thickness, length, not necessarily, but definitely thickness. So I would pair those guys together and have the roasted fingerling potatoes in the oven with the rosemary, blanching off my lima beans. And I would be, I'm going to put the pork chops on the grill because they're going to cook relatively quick. I have in my mind that they're about 8 ounce pork chops. Is that right, Tony?
Yes. I would never buy 8 ounce pork chops. It's way too small to me.
Oh, okay. Okay. Like what? 18-ounce pork chop?
This is me judging you. I mean, it doesn't have to be a 22-ounce pork chop.
All right.
But I think if, well, my, if unless you're at
okay,
least
12-ounce pork chop.
12 there, to 14, that's the sweet
okay.
spot.
A 12-ounce pork chop, which I'm going to be
and that's going to take more than a minute.
I'm going to rub them with some of the seeds from the Roma tomatoes because I'm going to dice those Romas and all the juice that comes out of the Romas and the skins. I'm going to smash it with my hand on the cutting board. Do I have garlic?
You do.
All dairy spice rack. Okay. Kitchen garden. Oh, I forgot I had my garden. All right. So I'm going to smash the tomato on the board with the garlic and extra virgin olive oil. And since I have my garden, I'm going to grab some sage from the garden. And I'm going to smash that in there too. And then I'm going to rub it all over the pork chops and marinate them for 24 hours because you said I have all the time in the world. So
all
I'm going to marinate.
All the time in the world.
Oh, stop saying it. So I'm going to marinate those overnight and they're going to taste really good.
Did you can write your name with a, your, with a knife and the fat on each chop.
I'm going to put some jalapeno in there too so it gets some spice in there. Oh, those pork chops are going to be good. And then with the nectarines, I'm going to cut the nectarine off the pit and I'm going to the ends on the skins I'm going to puree in the blender and the slices I'm going to toss with a little bit of the cilantro and corn oil and I'm going to grill them. So I'm going to have my marinated pork chops with my grilled nectarines and I'm also and I've already got my lima beans cooking and I'm going to actually add the lima beans to the jasmine rice. That's a bit of a Persian idea. I'm also going to add the fingerling potatoes to the jasmine rice. So that's really, oh my gosh, that's going to be so good. So that's the side dish. And cauliflower, I love cauliflower and I really just like it with brown butter. So I'm just going to do what I always do, which is blanch it and then salt it and just dress it with brown butter. And I did not use the mint. So the cilantro can also go into that nectarine marinade. That would actually be good. And the Roma tomatoes, I'm making a little salad. Oh, no, that's what I'll do. I'll make a little salad with the Roma tomatoes and the cilantro. And that'll also be a – because that'll taste good with the nectarines with the pork chops. And then the rice is really, truly a side dish. Like, I don't want that anywhere near my food. I want it in a bowl in the middle of the table. So people could just kind of do what they want with that.
I don't want that near my food.
That's it. That's what I did. All right. Tony, where's yours?
I have no idea. I do have it.
And there's no whole fish on there, Tony.
Okay.
All right.
I mean, I love whole fish, but good oh. Lord, give me some apparatus.
Uh-huh.
All right. Let's see.
Beg your pardon?
Some, never mind.
Go ahead.
Grilling. Saddle of lamb. Just like give me the grosse pièce, all right? Saddle of lamb. Okay. You might as well just give me the live animal. Garlic, shallot, onion, fava beans, lime, lemon, baby spinach, red wine. Thank you. I could use a glass after this. Cauliflower, extra virgin olive oil, lime stock,
that's funny.
Onions, celery, crack pot, no, carrots, all herb and spices, calamari. Okay.
And you end with calamari.
One of these is not like the,
the other.
Yeah. Okay. Calamari and the favas could be a very fun first course snack.
That's funny.
Sort of business. The calamari, the favas, a little garlic, shallot, and onion. Yeah, I would get a little pan going. The calamari, be nice to grill them as whole pieces. You know, I'm assuming that.
I love that.
Are the beaks,
I love
are
that.
The beaks gone?
No.
No,
it's dirty calamari. I should have put the word dirty down.
That's great.
Uh-huh. So that means they're whole.
So I've got to cut the beaks out.
Yes, you do.
Get rid of the ink sacs.
Unless you want to kill the people you're feeding.
Yeah, not my idea.
No.
I have the calamari bite them instead of the other way around. So with the calamari ones cleaned up, season them.
So you're talking about the tube or the whole tentacles and the tubes? Okay.
Tentacles and the tubes.
You're going to grill it?
Grill them. Just lightly mark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that takes all of about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
That's fast.
Not so long.
That's my kind of cooking.
Just long enough to get to get the juice out of them.
Right.
And then that goes in a pan right before the calamari. It gets sliced and goes in a pan with its juice. already working in that pan is the garlic, shallot, onion. And then once that's all warm, then the favas that have been blanched off, the favas go in there.
Yum.
And work that for a little bit. I think that is a great snack. The cauliflower, I would grill those slices, sort of like little steaks. Cut them kind of thick, season them well. And if you had a little bit of chili for that, which, of course, you want. Oh, it says all herbs and spices. A little Calabrian chili for that cauliflower. A little bit of that oil to season it when it comes off the grill would be great. And then just kind of lay those out like they're a plate because you know it's going to land there. That slices from the lamb saddle are going to land there. Lamb saddle to grill would be a bit of a bear. That's going to take all, an hour and a half?
Probably, yeah.
To deal with. You got to clean it up enough. I mean, because everything's there, you got to clean it up enough to make sure the pieces don't get burnt. There's no way you're going to have medium rare meat on this thing and have anything be finished.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at medium well for the nicest pieces, and some of it's going to be crispy and well around the edges. That's just going to have really good flavor. But to me, instead of trying to break it up, I would get that fire good and low, and you start it high to get it crispy. And then diffuse that fire, move the wood around a little bit, get it low, and just keep turning and moving that saddle. And you better have salted it well.
Mm, it's going
to
be
that's
so good.
That's the whole thing. You almost have to pretend like you're a Swedish masseuse with that with that lamb with salt and oil. Won't need much oil, but that's a big deal. And then when that comes off and you're able to cut slices, I would lay those slices out on that grilled cauliflower that has a little bit of Calabrian chili. And you can make just a little quick dressing for that with the oil and the lime juice that you have there. A little bit of shallot would be nice. If you had a little bit of mustard seed, it would be nice also. And just go ahead and dress that guy with that. The lime stock, it's too hot to make a sauce. I would reserve that. Put that in the freezer. The red wine, is a very fine bottle of Châteauneuf du Pape, and I would drink that
with
lime.
There you go. That's nice.
So, yeah.
Yes.
My afternoon's working out.
If only that was really carrots, happening.
Carrots, I just don't like that much.
You don't like carrots?
No, you have to like make
what?
I don't like them that much.
Mm, I love carrots. I can do a million things with carrots.
Good. You can have them.
All right.
All right. Well, I think that's all we have time for on Informing the Wolf on Food and Wine. If you want to download this or any of our other episodes, you can find podcasts on the WYPR website, wypr.org. Just go to the Foreman Wolf page and look them up. There's a whole bunch. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf or on Instagram as Chef Wolf.
My Instagram is the real Tony Foreman
versus the fake one.
Oh, God.
Because I'm sure out there. Somewhere.
I'm sure. Yeah, there are so many posers. And you can email us. It's foremanwolf@wypr.org if you have any questions, suggestions, ideas. Thank you so much for listening.
And have a great Sunday.